there's so much appetite for taking on employers. There's like this deep-seated rage among young workers that things are unfair and that we live in like a dystopian kind of capitalist nightmare. Everybody's talking about it, and it's processed through, you know, the medium of memes and GIFs and stuff, but it's widespread and it's in every job. Everybody goes out for a pint and says, I fucking hate my job, my manager is doing this, the wages aren't good enough, but it's not turning into action. The IW says, this is actionable. You can't take action on it. Here's how. Let's go. What are we waiting for?
Welcome to Turning Earth on Dublin Digital Radio. Turning Earth is a monthly show interviewing activists, researchers, organisers and various other troublemakers from across Ireland. I talk to people who hold varying perspectives, but what they all share is the understanding that the capitalist system is hostile to human and non-human life on this planet, and that when we act collectively, we possess revolutionary power that we can utilise to upend the system and build a more decent and humane society for ourselves, our families, friends and wider communities. Personal freedom can't exist without collective freedom, and political freedom is useless without economic freedom. Wages are stagnating in this country. Where they do increase, they still fall way behind the rate of inflation. The cost of basic goods continues to climb, alongside the profits of energy and utility companies. House prices keep flying up. Rent, where a gaff is even available, remains at a cost out of reach to most workers. But if we look to history, unions have been the tried and tested method for working people to fight for their rights, to have their basic needs met. These problems don't solve themselves. The capitalist system cannot find solutions by itself. The ruling class doesn't allow it. The problem here in Ireland is that most people aren't in unions. And if you meet someone who even has an opinion about unions in the first place, it's often a negative one. They're seen, unfortunately with good reason, as being out of touch with the grassroots, as being in cahoots with employers and the state, and basically as organisations that take a cut from your wage but that doesn't give you any help or any security in return. I've talked in this podcast before about CATU and interviewed members of CATU, I'm a member myself, the Community Action Tenants Union, about the struggle for a just housing system. But what about work? What about wages? Do any unions still exist that possess the will to fight alongside their members? Our guest this month is going to talk to us chiefly about that last freedom I mentioned, economic freedom, and how to fight for it. Last week I went down to North Strand, to the Dublin office of the Independent Workers Union, to speak to organiser Alex Hummets. We talked about what workplace struggles the union has had in its hands in recent times, what the outlook of the union is, why it's important to view workplace struggles as part of the class struggle, and most importantly, you'd hear a lot of good ideas about how you can start organising to improve your working life and build strength amongst your co-workers, how to turn colleagues into comrades. About two-thirds of the way through, one of the microphone transmitters died, so I had to give my mic over to Alex. My questions for that last section are a bit noisy because they're just getting picked up by the mic Alex was wearing, so hopefully that doesn't distract you too much. I've been using this setup for almost 2 years now, but I still consistently forget to charge the transmitters before an interview. Hopefully this will be the last time I make that mistake. But yeah, it's still audible, so hopefully it doesn't detract from the listening experience too much. Hope you enjoy the interview. Here's Alex.
For the benefit of the people listening, can you introduce yourself and say a bit about your background if you want, as much or as little as you like?
Sure, yeah. Alex Hummets is my name. I'm an ordinary working class man. I've grown up in Ireland. I'm originally from Estonia, which the far right has made a note to comment of repeatedly. My experience is that I was a member, and I have been a member of the Independent Workers Union. It'll be 10 years now in October, which is crazy to think of for myself. I've been a member of Unite when I worked in a job that had Unite members. As a matter of principle, I think you join the union that's there rather than split the group up. And then a couple of years ago, I was in Dunn's. I was elected shop steward. I was on the Dunn's National Committee. And then I was expelled from mandate, actually, for criticising officials. So the last 14 months or so, maybe a bit longer, I have fully integrated myself into the Dublin branch of the Independent Workers Union, and I've been organising with members of the Independent Workers Union.
And I know, so I've done a little bit of homework, not much now, but I know the IW was formed about 21 years ago. But I understand the roots of it go much deeper to the Cork Operative Butchers Society. But can you tell us a bit about maybe a little bit about the history of the union, if you can, but then ultimately, why was the union formed, why was it formed at that time?
Sure. So I suppose I'll start with giving you a little bit of history first. The Cork Operative Butchers Society has been in the same building in Cork City Centre on 55 North Main Street since, I think, the War of Independence. It shared the offices with the quote-unquote old IRA, with Flory O'Donoghue, the intelligence officer of the IRA, having his headquarters in the same office as the Cork Operative Butchers Society. And then in 1936, it was reconstituted. Since then, it was focused on organising butchers and anybody else who worked in the English market in particular, aptly or unironically named in Cork City Centre. To this day, it still maintains those butchers in there, despite the claims of others that butchers are no longer recognised or get the butcher's rate. And then in 2001, members of the ATGW, which we now know as Unite the Union, and members of other unions who were, frankly speaking, pissed off with the way in which the Irish Congress of Trade Unions was conducting itself, cutting deals with the state, social partnership. It was seen to be too close to government and too close to employers. So there was a push, chief amongst them by people like Noel Murphy, the former Secretary of the Trades Council of Cork, and other progressively minded people from up and down the country to set up kind of an alternative union that would be outside the Congress, that would champion the spirit of James Connolly and James Larkin. That was 2001, and for 23 years, the union, despite not being inside Congress, and I would say actively at times being undermined even, has continued to prosper and exist.
Sound. I'm sure most people listening now will know, or at least have some amount of knowledge of who James Connolly and Jim Larkin were. But when you say in the spirit of Connolly and Larkin, what do you mean? What's the ethos of the union then that sets it apart from others?
Well, promoting fighting employers, not conciliating or sitting around a table and having coffees and having a laugh. Class conflict was at the root of the Irish Transport and General Workers Union. It's not at the root of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, whose leaders praise people like Keir Starmer and the Irish Labour Party. That spirit is far and few in between, so we are very proud of ourselves for carrying on the flame of the likes of James Connolly and James Larkin. And when workers come to our union, we very honestly tell them, you may wait, you may send emails, petitions, but these things don't scare or intimidate or leverage companies into doing the right thing. What puts pressure on companies is workers withdrawing their labour and taking some sort of action to put pressure on them. That's the harsh reality.
Yeah. So on the topic of class conflicts, I know a big fight you had in your hands last year was the struggle of Iceland workers to get proper redundancy packages, because as far as I understand it, the supermarket was taken over by another company, and in a shadowy fashion were trying to close it down, resulted in a number of pickets and occupations. So can you tell us a bit about that struggle? How did it start, and what happened in the end?
Absolutely. So in February last year, on the 17th of February, we were contacted by Councillor Dahi Doolan from Sinn Féin, who was alerted by members of the Navan Road, Iceland Foods Ireland chain, that there was issues happening with their store, that it might be closed, that something is about to happen. Members of our union went out there and met the workers, and we got a very alarming picture of the situation on the ground. However, initially, none of the workers joined. They didn't join because there's no trade union culture in Iceland Foods Ireland. The vast majority, 99.9% of workers there, were in no union at all, with one or two being in some unions. So starting from that position, you not only have to explain the merits of organising in a union, but also that you are potentially facing an uphill battle. And the truth be told, I don't think any worker wants to hear that their business is about to close and they might have to pick a fight.
Yeah, yeah.
What alerted us to something questionable happening was when we started studying the Company Registration Office, which is a great tool for any trade unionist who wants to look into the wheelings and dealings of the company that they're negotiating with or organising in. And we found that the new company that took over had €10 in assets and was set up a week before. So this obviously sent alarm bells ringing. It was called Project Point Technologies, and it's the company, it's a subsidiary company of Mr. Naeem Maniar, who would then be the main proprietor of big business chains like Sense Retail and more prominently Home Savers, which is where kind of all the money is. Now, I don't have a crystal ball, and I didn't then, so we weren't trying to predict what he was going to do or what the plan was. But based on the balance of probabilities, it looked like it was a strategic winding down of the business. Kind of strip it, close it down, move on. Our first breakthrough really came when we had met up, courtesy of People Before Profit, so I should give credit where credit is due, with a group of workers in Coolock and Iceland, up on the north side, who alerted us to missing wages, issues with holiday pay, changes to holiday pay, their holiday pay entitlements being wiped out. So if listeners and yourself are unaware, when there's a transfer of undertakings, when you're bought out by one company to another, all your entitlements carry over. It's not like if you have 20 holiday days accrued because you didn't take your holidays last year and a new company comes in and says, well, you now need to earn all your holidays again. It doesn't work like that. Now, I think Mr. Naeem Maniar wanted it to work like that, but that's not how it works. So that's where really it all started. And the worse things got, the more people joined the union. The crunch really came last April, around this time actually, when all the heating and air conditioning was turned off in all of the stores in a cost-saving exercise. Now, the position of management at the time was that they were doing this in the interests of the environment, but it was pretty obvious in hindsight that what they were doing was trying to drive costs down, because actually he being Naeem Maniar, was ducking payments of rent to the landlords, utility bills and commercial rates to the council. So the whole thing was pay as little as possible and see what I can get out of it, or at least that's what it pointed to. So there was a wave of people who joined the union around this time last year, and off the back of that, off conversations, pub meetings, one-on-one phone calls, we told him that the only way he's going to listen to you is if you ballot for industrial action. So that's that is what we did around this time last year.
And how did that play out then once you took action? I know there was a number of occupations, particularly was it Talbot Street?
The occupations came after. So we balloted the four stores that we had members in, which was Talla, Ballyfermot, Coolock in Iceland and Northside. And the way it played out was that as soon as we informed the company we were balloting, there was a kind of carrot and stick approach in the stores. The owner would show up to the stores promising to resolve everything and that the union isn't good for the workers and that they don't need the union. There was personal comments made about myself and how I was only doing this in my own interests and all this kind of stuff. It was quite a bit of a roller coaster. So when I sit down and think about it, it's kind of, you're almost thinking that any of that really happened, about how mad some of it was and how mad some of the commentary was. When it came to strike week, the owner successfully, I would say, intimidated and lied to the workers to talk them out of strike action, with only Coolock and Northside going out on strike when that came about. Now, what I found was that the workers in the other shops unfortunately realized fairly soon that they were hoodwinked, and that the promises that were made about repaying old monies, about treating people properly, about guaranteeing jobs, were untrue.
So that was, sorry, was it Coolock and Ballyfermot you said stuck with it?
Coolock went out on strike initially, and then later on over the summer, when things were really getting difficult and the prospect of closure was hanging over everybody's head, when the Food Safety Authority pointed out that none of the frozen food had any permits and all the food had to be destroyed, the shops were sitting empty and idle, and we knew that this was another factor that sped up this process of closure. So Ballyfermot workers went out on strike, and this time there was no promises, there was no stick and carrot. They kind of just ignored the store. They didn't care. So I think at that stage we all knew the jig was up and the company was about to fold, and we were just waiting for Maniar's kind of next move, so to speak. His next move was to go, say he was away for 2 weeks, and when he came back, they began the redundancy consultation process. So it was kind of, I think somewhere along there the decision was made to wrap things up.
Yeah. Well, you were talking earlier that you copped the kind of, more than likely what was happening is that your man was stripping the company of his assets to sell it on. Is that something you've encountered before?
Well, it's pretty much the same formula that Debenhams undertook to kind of dismember the company and shift the debt somewhere else. So the reason they set separate companies up, I mean, they kind of companies and directors and owners, is so that if a company folds, it is a separate legal entity from your other kind of commercial empire, and all the debts can be extinguished or simply hanging there forever or whenever. Curiously enough, when court proceedings were underway and the liquidator was involved in July and August in particular, a letter was sent from Mr. Naeem Maniar's legal team to the British chain of Iceland Food, informing them and arguing with them that they had actually tricked them and moved debt onto the Irish company in order to let it kind of collapse deliberately. So we'll probably never know the truth of it, but kind of somewhat amusingly, the owner of Iceland Foods from the UK liked one of the IW statuses at some stage, calling out Naeem Maniar. So I don't know how it went down. I do know that the Sunday Times or the Telegraph Times, whatever newspaper it's called, had a piece on how this whole deal was made last February. And it had this interesting quote, which forever sticks to me how the wealthy operate. It said, over a 15-minute coffee, they decided that Naeem Maniar would take over the Iceland Foods Ireland. And you're thinking to yourself, over 15 minutes, they decided the fate of 390 workers and their futures so informally. So kind of the scale of how little interest they have in their own workers is really shown by how little time is put into kind of these handshake and a wink kind of deals.
Yeah, there's just numbers on a spreadsheet to them, I guess.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. That really is it.
And what happened with the workers in the end then? Did the company have to settle up with them?
So the Talbot Street workers, who initially didn't join the union but were subsequently shut down and had begun to engage with us then, contemplated the idea of an occupation and then made the decision to occupy the store, which we supported them in, our members supported them in. And the store was, I suppose, a physical leverage point for redundancies. The way it really turned out was that there was a process to seek what's called the protection of the courts when you're going through this kind of restructuring, but it was just to delay the process. And there was really no interest on their end in ever retrieving the Talbot Street store. So the way it really ended was that despite the occupation and the publicity, as far as I know, there was never real criminal investigation into how this company was structured and what went down. And ultimately, the state ended up picking up the tab through the social insurance fund.
Right, yeah. A bailout, essentially, like everything else.
In political terms, a bailout, yes. Mm. Because it was interesting, we were making this contrast. When the Food Safety Authority identified that the frozen food didn't have permits, you had HSE officers at 27 stores deployed immediately. But if your wages are robbed or you don't get the correct holiday pay, do you think if you ring the WRC, there'll be labour inspectors at your place of work questioning the employer or manager as to why you didn't get your wages? Of course not. Yeah. It's considered, you know, it's a civil matter. And for most ordinary workers, the last thing you're going to be doing is chasing up a week's wages through the WRC, which can take you 6 months to a year. So the way wage theft and mistreatment of workers is seen and treated is some sort of lengthy or convoluted civil process, you know, that needs to be taken, that needs adequate time to be taken and all this kind of stuff. But if I walk down the street and rob the chocolate bar, that's theft as well. And I would probably be charged for theft. But if the same shop robbed the wages of its workers, it wouldn't be seen that way. So it was a bit of a learning curve, I think, for those maybe who aren't as politically engaged or not following politics as much. Mm. I do recall when we went to the court, we attended as a group twice. And I could see, I could see a level of disappointment in the outcome of the court. Mm. Here were all these barristers where the fees for the day probably equaled what the workers were owed in the court. And the last thing on the mind of the judge and of the system and of the barristers and of the liquidator and the employer and the landlords was the workers.
Something that, I don't know if this is something you can talk about too much, but the... you're talking about your man when he took it over, he was avoiding rent and avoiding paying the utilities and all this. Like, surely that's another. Surely that's illegal. Like, if a tenant avoids paying rent,
it's a civil matter.
It's a
civil matter. And what we saw in the court was that some landlords had sent their barristers in to make their case, to demand payment or whatever. But this isn't the first time things like this have happened with the same character involved. Mm. We were contacted by people from up and down the country, including former landlords, who told us of similar experiences of rent not being paid. In one instance, it was alleged that the premise itself was occupied by staff obedient to Home Savers, that they stripped the place and then refused to leave until the amount due was quote-unquote forgiven. Mm. Now, if you're a small-time landlord, a commercial small-time landlord who inherited some industrial unit out in some business park, your options are like this. Chase your 50 grand in rent by spending another 30 or 40 grand in senior counsel and solicitors, or move on and try to get your rent back from another tenancy. And that's the way it played out in practice. Now, when we met some political representatives on the matter from different parties, not just progressive or left-wing parties, we were actually told that there's quite a lot of cases against Mr. Naeem Maniar for similar things. There was a viral video released around the same time of a tradesman who argued that he was owed €200,000 by Naeem Maniar, that he was never paid, and that Naeem Maniar was ignoring the courts and the judges' rulings as well. So there's obviously a very big problem there in how the law functions and allows people to do that.
Yeah. So we should probably move on from this shortly, but I guess just to wrap up that episode, could you say what the main kind of lessons learned from that struggle were, or what's the main takeaway from it, if you can distill it, anything?
It's a good question. We have divided opinions on this in the union. Some people say we won. I'm a bit more cynical in the sense that we did fight a good fight. We did put up our best resistance, but in the end, the jobs were gone, and it wasn't just about us arguing for better redundancies. We were trying to save the jobs because we didn't want the workers to lose their jobs. So in that sense, I don't think we succeeded. But the biggest takeaway, I think, is that more ordinary people should sign up to unions because they're capable of extraordinary things. It sounds a bit fluffy when I say it like that, but in the context of how that played out, the Iceland workers would have really benefited from an overall higher worker density and a deeper appreciation of what their experience was and what they were going through from other workers. Because if there was that link made, perhaps we could have done better. If we had an in into the other shops that Mr. Naeem Maniar owned, perhaps the solidarity could have been stronger. But I'm speculating, really.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm overly self-critical because I was kind of centrally involved in the dispute. So we'll do better next time and we'll fight the good fight. But I don't think we won that particular battle.
So can you tell us what struggles is the union currently involved in? You mentioned earlier that there's a few new workplaces opening up.
Sure. So at the moment, we are conducting both surveys and campaigns in a few different places. We have two surveys ongoing in the fast food sector and security officers to mostly non-union industries with terrible terms and conditions and low pay. And our surveys are beginning to kind of consolidate that anecdotal information. From the surveys, we will then craft campaigns around worker-specific workplaces if they're up for them themselves. So that's kind of one block of activities. The other block of activities is that we've seen an influx of members from the HSE. 99% of them are switching from SIPTU to the Independent Workers Union because they feel that they're not adequately represented or supported. And then we are looking at a bit of a breakthrough in ABTRAN, although it's probably too early to say that confidently, but there is a bit of a working group developing also off the back of a very, I would say, coincidental survey for call centers in general, which we ran last year, which one worker from ABTRAN, believe it or not, filled out. we got in touch with him, and suddenly we were able to contact many other people interested in unionising and expand, gradually but slowly build relationships and expand the campaign to include not just one or two people, but a couple of hundred. So those are kind of, I would say, the most exciting prospects coming up. As the IW is a general union, we get queries from every type of worker you can think of in your head. We get queries from them, from cleaners in private agency companies to civil servants in the lower grade from other unions to call centres. I've mentioned security officers. Retail is quite a popular one and common one as well. More recently, home helps, baggage handlers in the airport. I could sit here probably all day listing off the kind of backgrounds workers have when they're approaching us.
Yeah. And what's ABTRAN that you mentioned?
ABTRAN is, and this might give you an indication of its environment, is an outsourcing centre built in Ireland. It's a giant call centre company, essentially. Its contracts are split between some major private contracts, but it gets quite a lot of government contracts as well, which will be interesting when our dispute begins to flare up and it is acknowledged or at least questioned as to why state bodies or semi-state bodies are giving ABTRAN their contracts.
And the HSE workers you mentioned there, I suppose a couple of questions there. What if you can say, like, what are the issues that they're experiencing that they're looking for union representation for? And maybe as well, you could talk a bit about, I mean, you already mentioned it a bit, but what's the nature of the dissatisfaction with CIP2? Why are they seeking a different union?
I'll answer this question with one answer, because it'll cover both aspects. Since 2016, there has been what's called a job evaluation scheme. And what the job evaluation scheme is that they take workers in a hospital, so for example, cleaners, caterers, porters, admin staff, etc., and they ask them, what is it that you do? List out and explain your responsibilities. For all the things that you might do in a day, you get points. The HSC and CIP2 signed up to this methodology, and I note, without balloting their members, but also with no right of appeal. So on the outcome of these job evaluation scheme, several groups of workers were either left in bands that they were dissatisfied with, too low, or they didn't have any increase in their pay at all. So they didn't go up a band, which is particularly hurtful for workers like cleaners, who the Dáil would have stood and clapped for in the middle of COVID and how much we appreciate them. But in practice then, they were left on band 4, which is the lowest band, despite literally cleaning people's blood, sweat and tears, cleaning infected COVID wards and the like. So they're particularly grieved. And the core of this dissatisfaction with CIP2 is that CIP2 signed up to this process. So obviously the question must be raised as to why their own union signed up to a process that has no right of appeal. We have this in confirmation. Thomas Pringle TD put in a parliamentary question and we got the answer back this week that this is part of the quote-unquote collective agreement. And to us in the IW, we're kind of sitting around and thinking, why the fuck would any union sign up to a clause that has no right of appeal? Now, I've been told reliably that CIP2 are beginning to make some noise about this. Okay, that's fine. But it's too little too late. For they created the problem in the first place by agreeing to it without balloting their members. I can only speculate as to why they didn't ballot their members, but I could give you a pretty good guess that they probably would have voted no if the ballot was put to them. So that put together has created a lot of unhappiness. And before the Iceland dispute, our union wouldn't have had the profile to capture large groups of members who were trapped in a union that they didn't have their voice in. That has changed. CIP2 members in hospitals are now turning around going, well, hang on a second, the IW can take our cases for us, they can ballot us for industrial action, they'll represent us and they'll support us. Why would I stay in CIP2?
Yeah.
Hopefully this is a wake-up call for CIP2 to get their act together. Hopefully this changing of, I wouldn't say a huge amount of people, by the way, the vast majority are still in CIP2 or no union, as many people are doing. They simply resign out of frustration. I don't have my fingers crossed, but I hope that the pressure from people leaving and making noise is heard and felt and taken on board. Then there's the other thing. The HSC and other civil bodies, civil servants, structures, semi-state bodies, etc., have a recruitment freeze to make up the money. We discovered recently, it's quite interesting, in Cork University Hospital, there was a notice put up. And imagine in any job, a notice is put up that says, don't worry about your annual leave too much, we're understaffed, so it'll be kind of case by case. There was murder over it. The workers went straight to the media, the radios, our members went to us, started asking questions. Murder. What's interesting is that prominent newspapers like the Irish Times and the Independent and others have simultaneously covered the fact that the HSC is spending $500 million on agency staff. So on the one hand, they're saying there's no money to hire HSC staff. On the other hand, Noonan's and other contract cleaning agencies have workers in our hospitals doing the job. Again, not everybody sees maybe the broader picture or sees beyond, you know, the frustration of their own situation, which is, fuck it, I can't access my annual leave, we're understaffed, I'm doing the job of three workers. And I totally appreciate why you wouldn't think about anything beyond that, because that in of itself is very, very frustrating. But the bigger picture here is that this is privatisation by stealth. It's privatisation of every single hospital. What we found doing a bit of investigation and with some passive support from rank and file SIPTU members is, in Cork at least, the local SIPTU official sat in the same meeting and would outwardly to the public state that they were against the privatisation. And it's probably SIPTU policy to be against privatisation, but inside closed meetings, and I have the minutes of this meeting, they were agreeing to the bringing in of contract agency cleaners. Yeah. So which is it, really? Because you can't have it both ways. And that's, all of that is fueling this rage and frustration and anger among cleaners and household staff and domestics and catering staff and porters. And that's why they're switching over.
Yeah, you've kind of just bringing me up to one of my last questions. You've already kind of answered it, I guess, but like a lot of people do see, like when I'm chatting to people about unions, you know, it's talked about like...
negatively.
Like, yeah, like it's something from the past, you know.
They're being categorised as part of the establishment.
Yeah.
And to some degree, I agree with people. Some unions have acted in a way that is objectively against the interests of their own members. Why they do that, I'm not the person to ask, though the officials who make these decisions are. One particularly egregious one that has stuck in the craw, particularly of water workers in SIPTU, is that the Irish Congress of Trade Unions has a policy to oppose the privatisation of water. But for some bizarre reason, the former General Secretary of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, Patricia King, sits on the board of Irish Water.
Fuck off, really?
Yes, yeah. So people aren't stupid. They can see that this is quite duplicitous. Yeah. That's on a large scale. On a smaller scale, I get told stories where an official comes into, say, a hospital. They'll have a pre-meeting with the HSC manager and then they'll bring the worker in. What kind of message does that send to any worker, any reasonably minded worker? Does it say that this person represents me and my interests, or does it suggest that the person may be in cahoots with management? I'm not saying they are, but that's certainly the optics of what's going on. I'll give you another rather interesting example. We have a case ongoing at the moment, so no names. It's in a call centre. We have one member. He's just a member from experience. We didn't have a recruitment campaign in the call centre. And he has a disciplinary coming up. It's a different meeting, but I'm going to say disciplinary so that it can't be identified. The HR manager emailed him today to say that although he's not a member of another major Irish Congress of Trade Unions union, she rang the General Secretary and they would be happy to represent him on this one occasion without him having membership. And you must sit to yourself and think, what kind of relationship is that, that the HR manager can ring up the General Secretary and knowingly full well this man is a member of another union, take on a case like that? Yeah. It makes you wonder. But it's not just us wondering. It's also your average workers wondering.
Yeah, yeah.
The situation on the ground, in particular people who might have grown up in some of the bigger unions and then left, is that there's an incipient anti-union mentality. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, I find that long kind of lifers of the trade union movement, so for example, our HSC staff are all, one worker, for example, just to kind of give flesh to the bones, one worker got the job, he didn't have a junior cert at the time, that's how long he's there in his position. So he's a lifer in SIP2, formerly in SIP2, and he's changed over. And the question you have to ask is, what could be so damning that would force even people like that to switch, to finally, after 40 years, 45 years of membership of one union, to make a switch to another trade union? And not only that, but bring their whole crew of workers with them. So there is something going on, and I'm glad that people like that haven't given up on trade unionism as a broad idea. But there are people who have, a lot of very cynical security officers out there in particular, a sector, by the way, that SIP2 purport to represent.
Right. What is it that has security workers particularly aggrieved?
Well, SIP2 would have recognition agreements with the security officers, for example, who guard Connolly Station and the trains and the darts and Euston Station. They would have agreements with some of the other state institutions that are guarded, like the Four Courts and other places. But they also have an agreement with a company called G4S, which is a company very closely connected to the British Ministry of Defence. But they would also do contracts for the Israeli army and guards. And the agreement, strictly speaking, would be covered under what we call collective bargaining. But the agreement specifically has clauses which delay any sort of industrial action. And this is, I think, the crux of why the IWU was set up. You can't say you're representing workers and then sign up to no strike agreements. The strike is the strongest weapon any groups of workers have. It should never be signed away by any trade union under any circumstances. Unfortunately, that is what's being signed away time and time again. Even in the most recent government pay deal, the paltry 10.25% spread across 2.5 years, which is below inflation, so real-time pay cut, and, you know, ICTU is celebrating this as a great victory for workers. It's even written into that the unions, and by default the members, who thankfully were balloted at least on this stage, cannot make pay claims in the first year of that agreement. So you're signing up to say your members cannot take action on pay in exchange kind of for this payoff. And that's a very big fucking problem, because it ties the hands, it's not the 1990 Act tying the hands of workers. It's their own unions pushing through bad deals and not wanting to rock the boat with the state, which is the country's biggest employer.
We talked a bit about this before we were recording, but you come across that idea a lot, that all of the issues in today's union movement go back to the Co-Part Agreement of the 1990 Act. But what if it's not that, or if it's not just that, what do you think? Where do you think that culture comes from, of the sort of collaboration between the state and the union leadership?
It goes all the way back to the fucking day they shot James Connolly in the head and killed him. The Labour movement and James Connolly were on two completely separate levels, and through charisma, political aptitude and leadership skills, he was able to knit it together and keep it together. But we have to remember, who were the first parties that formed the first government in the Irish Free State? It was Cumann na Gael, and it was the fucking Labour Party, backed up by the ITGW. So for 100 years, it's been a generally conservative institution, and its leadership has been conservative. That's not to say there hasn't been radical figures, but you have to also remember that when Larkin came back, and SIP2 and ICTU loved to celebrate Larkin, but sure, they expelled him when he came back from America, from the ITGW as it was. And that's why he went and set up the Workers' Union of Ireland, his own union entirely. And it was only after his death that his son, or his second son, played a role in reintegrating the two unions back together. So all this rich history is there, and the picture it paints is that this collaborationist, almost like Italian fascist-style corporatist approach to, you know, where equal partners and all-class alliance, that has existed in the Free State since Connolly's death, I would say. Sure, in the Civil War, the position of the labour movement pioneered by William O'Brien and Johnson, two of Connolly's contemporaries, was, sure, we're neutral. We won't take any part in this. Mm-hmm. Absolutely crazy, considering to think the politics of James Connolly and James Larkin only 5 years before that. So I think it predates the 1990 Act, but I think the 1990 Act is a very convenient way for both officials, especially who don't want to do a lot of work and are happy to refer everything to the WRC and sit on their hands for 6 months while they collect their 60-70k salaries. But I also think it's convenient for people who don't want to go out and organise workers. It's easy to say, sure, the 1990 Act, we can't do anything. Why think outside the box or find the grey areas or find where it can be bent or changed or modified or challenged? Why bother with any of that? And that's definitely a conversation that needs to be had. Stop pinning everything on the 1990 Act. There has been plenty of industrial disputes since 1990, many of which have not been targeted by the 1990 Act. That's not to say they're not targeted. But this boogeyman that's been set up, we're almost setting up ourselves to failure. Sure, we can't go on strike because of the 1990 Act. Is there any substantive explanation as to why that is? No. In fact, what our experience suggests is that not only can you work the 1990 Act to take industrial action as long as you follow the very basic rules. So if you're not familiar with them, it's very straightforward. You have to have a secret ballot. Your union has to have rules on how a secret ballot is conducted. The outcome of the secret ballot has to favour industrial action. And you have to give 7 days notice to your employer. That's it. So theoretically speaking, you and I could walk up to a factory, recruit every single person with a leaflet. An hour later, we could meet them in the pub and give them all ballots to ballot for industrial action. The following day, we could write to the employer and say, we've balloted for industrial action. The outcome has been in favour. Here's your 7 days' notice. Best of luck. And it's perfectly lawful. So why is it that it has taken this long, at least, to come to this realisation? I don't know. That's a question that should be put to the people who champion the idea that you can't do anything with the 1990 Act. I mentioned earlier, however, a large obstacle is the deals that unions themselves sign their members up to. So if you sign up to no strike clause agreements, of course you can't take strike action. You signed up to the fucking thing in the first place. So the question isn't whether the 1990 Act is stopping them, is why have you argued for the insertion of contractual clauses in the contracts of the employees of G4S to say that they need to exhaust all this? So they're not going to do that. It takes too long. Whatever momentum exists for taking some sort of action can as quickly dissipate or fizzle or be stomped out of the workers by management. And I can damn well bet you that companies and management know all of that completely. So it seems that the only people that argue that it benefits are kind of your keyboard trade unionists, employers and officials who would love nothing more to say, oh, you have a great campaign at the store. This happened to me personally, actually. You have a great campaign at the start, let's refer to the WRC. And I the stress of it all, I spent more time fighting with my official back then than I did with the company employer, which is notoriously anti-union. So it's kind of almost hilarious that that was the case.
So you're fighting with them to try and get them to actually do the work themselves?
Yes. Because the atmosphere on the ground is that there's so much appetite for taking on employers. There's like this deep-seated rage among young workers that things are unfair and that we live in like a dystopian kind of capitalist nightmare. Like, it's everybody's talking about it, and it's processed through, you know, the medium of memes and GIFs and stuff, but it's widespread and it's in every job. Everybody goes out for a pint and says, I fucking hate my job, my manager is doing this, the wages aren't good enough, but it's not turning into action. The IW says, this is actionable. You can't take action on it. Here's how. Let's go. What are we waiting for?
I think we talked about this earlier, but I don't know if we got it recorded, but I think it'd be worth repeating it again just because it's a good example, I think, of just how shit some of these agreements are. I think it was the agreement presented that it said to him was a G4S.
G4S, yeah.
Yeah, so what was involved in that?
Yeah, so every G4S employee is bound by two core contractual obligations. Number one is that they must be a member of SIPTU. Okay, that's fairly standard in a closed shop agreement, which is what it's called, that you have an agreement exclusively with an employer and people are signed into the union. Theoretically speaking, there's no problem with that. The problem is with the other core agreement that SIPTU have with G4S that specifically says you have to go through all these hoops before you can consider industrial action. And as we were discussing earlier, the average time for a WRC case is 6 months. If you appeal the outcome of the decision, you could be waiting another year for the Labour Court to hear it. And then just to add salt to the wounds, it says there must be a 14-day cooling off period. So instead of the scenario I laid out for you earlier, where in theory you could process strike action in 8 days, let's say 14 days to be generous, because you need time to count the ballots, distribute the ballots, etc. SIPTU have signed up their own members, the workers of G4S, into this long-winded structure that refers things to state bodies, and maybe down the line you'll get a recommendation from the Labour Court, because we also have to remember that a lot of the decisions of the Labour Court aren't even binding, they're recommendations. The dictionary definition of a recommendation suggests that an employer does not have to follow a recommendation. And what if they don't? Well, then SIPTU turn around and might say, well, now we're going to ballot. The energy, the enthusiasm, the anger, along with the people who had it, could all very well be gone. And this is particularly acute in migrant workers who look for justice, are met with this brick wall, and so they go, what the fuck is the point of being in a union? That skepticism is interesting because it's as common among non-native workers that is, as it is among, I would say, like middle-aged Irish workers. Younger workers just don't know what unions are. If you walk into a coffee shop up the road and say, do you want to join the union, they'll look at you like you're speaking Chinese.
Yeah, it's an uphill struggle then, it sounds like.
It is an uphill struggle. And the practical reality of that is we have to concentrate our resources on winning strategic battles and demonstrating the trade union organisation works, that it gets the goods, that we can win, and that there's a way to use the existing legislation, and no problem. And if there's grey areas that can be found, we'll identify the grey areas. If there's means and ways to circumvent the more rigid applications, we'll do that. And we're doing that. That is what the IW does. I would love to be on a fly on the wall of some of the HR managers who've received our letters in the last couple of months and in the last year. You know, in the National Maternity Hospital, the HR manager specifically said, and I quote, as you are not a member of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, you will not be able to take strike action, which we obviously thought was quite entertaining because it showed not only a deficit in knowledge, but also the placing and the framing of industrial disputes, as in they see their partners, and that's the problem word here, as another, this other bigger union. And I suppose when you read about Connolly and Larkin and you read about industrial disputes and trade unionism, trade unions and employers are not partners. They're on polar opposites. They're two different sides. They represent two different interests. Unions represent workers and companies represent capital. They represent employers. They represent profit. The two are inherently contradictory.
I think the word you used earlier, corporatist, is an important one to that people understand, I think, because I recorded a walk there recently with Conor McCabe, and he was going through the history of grassroots political struggle and labour struggle, and that's how he described the union movement, as a corporatist, almost fascist model of organising, where there's this like...
Absolutely. If the state turned around tomorrow and said, ICTU, would you like a social partnership? They wouldn't be putting their shoes on fast enough to run over to government buildings to bow and scrape and sit there and hum and haw and laugh about things. And that's not just part of their own political spinelessness. It's part of the fact that, and I'm meaning to get around to doing this, but I'd like to make a list of all the former trade union officials who've ended up on various boards and committees and government jobs. Because I shit you not, there's a very big overlap of things there as well. The author of the 1990 Act, Kevin Duffy, for example, ended up as president of the Labour Court. A very well-paying job. So make of that what you will.
We're really coming up in time, so just a couple of more questions to fire at you before we finish. I read that the IWU recently affiliated with the World Federation of Trade Unions.
Yes.
Could you tell us a bit about that and why the IWU decided to join?
So internationalism is a very strong and has always been a very strong element of those who are radically minded. In fact, it was a huge component of James Connolly's own work, who learnt Yiddish and German to organise migrant workers in New York. He was Scottish born and he ended up organising and dying in Ireland. So as part of that internationalism, we examined potential partners who we would be close to in kindred spirit. And the World Federation of Trade Unions reflects our core values, which are based on class. We are a class-orientated union. We are for the working class. It's not about conciliating employers. It's about taking the battle to them to win improved terms and conditions. The World Federation of Trade Unions is very much in that camp. They have particularly strong affiliates in and outside of Europe, which is very important because the European trade union structures are as compromised, I would say, as the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. And then the few ones that are in the World Federation of Trade Unions, for example, PAME in Greece, would be among the most militant trade union movements in Europe, who block NATO cargo trains from bringing weapons shipments, regularly go out on general strike, regularly challenge the state and private employers. That's where we need to be at. That's where we can be at. So in spirit, that's the structure and the alliance of unions that reflects us most. But importantly as well, our struggle isn't, you know, this European kind of white man struggle, which is certainly the impression one would get from looking around at some of the structures that exist. It's a global one. And the World Federation of Trade Unions is affiliated to Chinese trade unions, Korean trade unions, Vietnamese, Laotian, the Cuban Federation of Trade Unions. That's the camp we're in. That's the camp we want to be in. So that's who we decided to affiliate to.
Makes sense. So I suppose to wrap us up now, you've already talked about a lot of this stuff, but just kind of to summarise for people, what we already talked about the perception of unions as being sort of pointless, they don't do anything for workers. What sets the IWU apart from other unions? You know, why should people join, in other words? And I think you already talked about this, but can workers from any industry join, and how do people join? What's the practical end of it?
Well, what sets us apart is that we believe inherently that unions represent one set of interests and employers and management represent another set of interests. Those interests are inherently contradictory and that we have to fight to improve our line. And you see how over time, even the arguments people make are diluted and watered down. In the past, for example, if a factory was closing, the union would come in and it would be the ITGW or the ATGW or whatever. And they'd come in and say, no, we're not closing the factory down. Now we argue about who gets how much redundancy. So everything has become diluted and watered down by neoliberalism. And unfortunately, mainstream trade unions have facilitated that. We think we live in a period of time not just marked by ecological and imperialist instability, it's also marked by record inequality. And that needs to be challenged. It needs to be challenged. There's no need to reinvent the wheel. We need to bring back regular strike activity. We need to put the fear of employers back. They need to think twice before they sit down at their corporate meetings and their five-star hotels and decide to cut 1,000 workers here and 1,000 workers. They go, what's the union going to do about this? Or the response to the union is probably going to be very strong and we should probably be very careful about what we do. And to get to that point, we have to take lots and lots of action. Are mainstream trade unions doing this? That is a discussion for themselves to have. Our perspective, as it was in 2001 and as it is now, is that they're not doing it. Officials are too comfortable. Members who are activists who speak up tend to be sidelined or isolated. So what do you do? The Independent Workers Union exists to focus and hone in on that anger and energy and to direct it somewhere productive. We'll fight the good fight even if nobody else does. You can join through the website, but to be honest, I think it's not just about signing up and we need to get rid of this conception. You see it on Twitter often, just join a union. It's not like that. It's not just about filling in your application form and paying your dues. The caliber of every union is also determined by the quality of its members. A union is only as good as its members. Complacent members make for a complacent union. Active members make for a strong union. The IW is no different. So I think if you're in a non-unionized workplace, talk to your coworkers. There's no point signing up and saying nothing. You need to raise your head above the parapet, whether you like it or not. We all do. It's not down to, you know, I'll keep my cushy spot and the union will argue for me. It doesn't work like that. Organize your coworkers, get them into a group meeting, have that conversation about the union, talk about action, and we'll facilitate it. We'll back you to the hilt. We'll be there with you, sleeping on the floor of the Talbot Street Iceland shop right next to you if need be. That's the struggle and the point that we're at. So we have a website, we have a link tree, we have a load of social media. I don't think I need to spell it out, any of it. If you look up Independent Workers Union, it all comes up. But I would start by talking to your coworkers. Of course, get in touch with us and we'll help give you a steer, you know, even things to say or slightly more tactical things to say in order to persuade people or explain. We'll give you the rundown of how the law functions. What are your rights? Is it lawful to be dismissed for trade union activity or not? Is it lawful to take industrial action or not? Of course, we'll help with all of that. But I think the first part of call is to talk to your co-workers, which most of us already do, by the way. That's what I find, is that people complain bitterly about their terms and conditions. The gap missing is, let's take some fucking action and show our company what's what like. If we don't get this wage increase, while our owner drives up in a Lexus and says, you know, you all need to work harder, the coffee shop isn't doing as well as it should be, we need to take action. That's the message we need to put across. And I would be more than delighted if members of ICTU unions did that as well. That, I would welcome that.
Sounds. I think that's enough for now. So thanks for taking the time, Toppy. Appreciate it.
Brilliant. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks again to Alex for taking a bit of time to speak to us, and thanks to you for listening. If you value this podcast, if you think it's a useful resource, please take a minute to leave a 5-star review on whatever podcast platform you listen on. Most podcast apps have some facility for reviewing and rating, so please leave a 5-star rating, and if there's a way to subscribe, please subscribe. This is very important, because the more people that do that, get spread into other people's feeds, and more people will hear it then. So it's a very quick and direct way for you to help spread the messages that we're concerned with propagating. So if you can do that, it'll only take a minute. Please go ahead and do that now. And if you're in a position to contribute some money, please head over to patreon.com/turningearth and subscribe. There's numerous different tiers there. I think it starts at €2 or €2.50 per month. You can always subscribe for a while and then unsubscribe if it doesn't suit you. But remember, this is independent media. It can't work without your help, without you taking an active part in it, so please do what you can. And lastly, if you have any questions, suggestions or criticisms, please get in touch at turningearthradio@gmail.com. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Alex, and I hope you're inspired now to go and join the IWU or the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, or any other fighting union. Get active in your workplace and organise to defend your rights. If you're listening live on DDR, stick with us here. Alternative to What is up next. That's all for now. Slán agus beannacht.